From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
What we need in the world is more tranquility, because the world has been upended, you know, and the number of corks have been taken out of the bottle.
The longtime permanent representative of the Russian Federation to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin, dead at age 64.
In Libya, we had the cork taken out of the bottle, and all the problems in Africa, which were exacerbated by the crisis in Libya, by the toppling of Gaddafi, you know, ruining the Libyan state, essentially. You know, all those problems started flowing out of Africa, Northern Africa, Sahel region, etc., etc. And then another bottle was uncorked in Syria, when one of the most successful countries in that part of the world was destabilized. So another flow of problems into Europe started coming from Syria. So this is one of the very serious challenges, I think, is to find a way to bring back some degree of stability, and then we'll be able to work on the socio-economic and other problems.
RT's Gayan Chichikayan has more.
For 11 years, Vitaly Churkin had been the face and the voice of Russia at the United Nations, vigorously representing the country's position, even if it meant sharp exchanges with his counterparts at the UN Security Council.
Russia is known for its literary greatness, and what you just heard from the Russian ambassador showed more imagination than Tolstoy or Chekhov.
Ms. Powell started her speech mentioning Tolstoy and Chekhov, but finished it down on the level of the tabloid press. We categorically disagree with insulting comments towards our country.
Outside the tense debates at the UN, there was a different Vitaly Churkin, known to many for his sense of humor.
You've been here a long time. You've seen four or five different...
Thank you for reminding me.
He has been in diplomacy for a long time. In 1986, then-Soviet Embassy Secretary Vitaly Churkin, in an extremely rare instance for a Russian diplomat, went to the U.S. Congress to answer lawmakers' questions about the catastrophic accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. According to the media at the time, he impressed many. The LA Times wrote Churkin became an instant media star, noting his youthful good looks and fluent English as he deftly parried sharp questions from the lawmakers. At that congressional hearing, he was quoted as saying, "If you want to talk to my country in a commanding tone, forget it." The Washington Post at the time called him Vitaly, charm your pants off. A year later, in 1987, he did an interview with C-SPAN talking about glasnost policy in the Soviet Union and relations with the U.S.
It is a complete overhaul of our society, a modernization, if you will, of our society, and openness, glasnost, is an important part of it. It means basically that things should be discussed and brought out in the open, and that everybody has to be involved. It is a part of democratization of our society.
We'll have more on the passing of Russia's ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin, in tomorrow's newscast. Today, a conversation with BlackAgendaReport.com columnist Danny Haifong about his piece this week, Why Is It Time to Move On, from MoveOn.org and the Nonprofit Industrial Complex.
The nonprofit industrial complex is definitely an omnipresent feature of the United States at this point. You know, I've worked just coming out of college. I've worked in a variety of nonprofits, mostly in the social service sector. And, you know, in this period of neoliberal capitalist crisis, nonprofits have been given basically the full responsibility by the federal government to administer vital services. And, you know, nonprofits are tax-exempt entities that give, you know, wealthy one percenters the ability to donate and basically get a full return, if not a profit, on their donations through tax breaks. And not many people know this, but what also is insidious about nonprofits is that their roots, actually I worked at one of these agencies, their roots were actually based in the the decision by the Johnson administration during the so-called war on poverty period to break the independent character of the Black Liberation Movement. So in the 1960s, there were rebellions, you know, open rebellions, armed rebellions of Black people destroying cities in response to the continued institutionalized racism that they were experiencing in the so-called post-war World War II boom.
And racist violence by the government, by the way.
Yep. And the police brutality and the police murder, which, you know, of course, we know persists to this day at an even more intensified level. So, yeah.
They have better guns now.
Yep. Nonprofits really have the roots there. But now we're in the 21st century, and nonprofits are even bigger and have much more of a private character.
Yeah. And just to interrupt also, that development, you know, parallels the privatization of a lot of government functions that, you know, began, well, even earlier than Johnson, but certainly got new wind blown into it during Johnson and then Reagan, where a lot of functions, including public housing and various, you know, things intended to alleviate poverty and other negative effects of capitalism, became privatized. And they are actually legally, many of these, the 501c3s, for example, designated as charities.
Yep. And as you stated, you know, I have a lot of experience in this phenomenon where, you know, there was a huge cut during the Reagan era of over 77% of the budget authority of the Housing and Urban Development Program. And over those 30 years or so since, what you see is a severe reduction in housing services provided by the government in a correlation increase of nonprofits that provide, you know, much more means tested and reduced services that can only really reach a tiny segment of the population. And we can see this in education too, where districts across the country are cutting public education funds, are cutting funds of public education, while big nonprofits like Teach for America, you know, enter into the education sphere to provide a scab labor force bankrolled by Goldman Sachs and various other one percenter institutions from finance capital.
You see some things here, like here in Austin, New York, for example. They cut back public funding of programs like music courses, art courses, drama, you know, whatever. And so, you know, as a stopgap, people organize to raise money for these things. There are these, you know, legal structures that are available for, you know, educational charity work through both New York State Department of Education, Federal Department of Education, and nonprofit law generally, and grants available. So there are music programs that are provided, you know, through these private funding mechanisms, and then there is the political game that goes on of awarding these to whichever group is most closely aligned to the local power structure. So in a municipality where the Democrats have made majority registration, the local Democratic committee bestows these funds on the favored groups. Where you have majority Republican enrollment among the voter base, then the local Republican committee does it. Or in a place like Westchester County, where you have a powerful Republican and state county and Democratic county committee, you know, they broker it. You have the Inns, who, you know, are representing the Republican Party here, the Democratic Party there, maybe in the same law firm with a Republican and Democratic partner, and they're the ones that wave the magic wand at the favored programs.
Exactly. And these nonprofits that have sprouted in the social services sector, in the public sector, in order to basically swallow it with funds from both of the two parties, are not relegated to the social service sector and the public sector.
Right.
We know still that, especially in this, this huge, protest movement against Donald Trump, we see that the original purpose of the nonprofit, which was to basically break the independent character of social movements, has not eroded. In fact, it's probably grown. And I, you know, in my piece, I talk about MoveOn.org because what I noticed at a lot of these protests is that MoveOn.org signs are everywhere. And
yeah, before we go there, let's, because you give a really good history of the development of the phenomenon. Let's go back, start maybe with CAP. Most communities are familiar with the Community Action Program. And so why don't you give us a little bit of the lineage of this first, and then we can come to the, you know, the modern manifestations of the phenomenon.
Sure. I actually worked at a second wave CAP agency because most of the first waves are gone. This one also happened to close because of a lack of federal funds to a lot of the grants that it received for housing services and legal services and that sort of thing. So CAP agencies, yeah, were formed during the war and poverty period. And Lyndon Johnson gave a famous speech where he said that the primary purpose of the war on poverty was to turn tax eaters into taxpayers. And he was specifically referring to Black Americans because there was a lot of conversation inside of Washington at the time about, well, what is exactly at the root of this phenomenon? Why are Black Americans rebelling in the major city centers of the United States, especially in a period where workers in general, their conditions were much improved from, you know, just 30 years ago. So, you know, there's a whole commission that was created to study this phenomenon, and CAP agencies were basically the institution that was given responsibility to provide anti-poverty services to communities, especially Black communities. And a lot of them were run by community members themselves. They received a lot of loose federal funds, and you know, a lot of CAP agencies around the country did some pretty interesting things, and also participated in things like protests and demonstrations in order to win vital services. However, you know, 40 years later, what we've seen is the complete privatization of all social services. This includes the housing and urban development, which ultimately provided a lot of funds for things like CAP agencies. So the one I worked for in 2013, 2014, eventually had to close its doors because it couldn't even get, you know, a pitiful, you know, the grants, you know, equaled out to maybe 120,000 here, 140,000 there. And we couldn't even secure that. So a lot of CAP agencies now relied on private bank loans that collected interest, and nonprofits don't create any revenue. They're completely bound by their funders. And so when that happened, it closed. And, you know, you can just see the landscape now in this period where the majority of nonprofits are not funded by the federal government. The majority of nonprofits in the United States, regardless of where you're looking, in housing and education or in the social movement industry, which is in fact a real industry, are funded by big foundations with wealthy one percenters like George Soros, like the Walton family.
Ford Foundation, like et cetera.
The Carnegie family, yeah. These are the real funders of nonprofits now, and they always carry with them the interests and the motivations of those funders.
Yeah, so let's back out of this a little bit. I remember, for example, the period when you had community organizers who were organizing to lobby for federal funding for housing, because there still is, but at the time there was such a desperate need for federal funds for housing, and it was federal legislation that was intended to do that. They built public housing, you know, all of this, and some of the, you know, best community organizers in terms of the most successful and most dedicated community organizers ended up securing funding. And then, forgetting the character of the individuals, because as Marxists, you know, we're not supposed to be just looking at, you know, whether this person or that person is moral or ideologically committed, but at social forces and, you know, the actual movement of the society and the, you know, the pressures and, you know, operation of the various forces within the society. So you have this group of people who were organizers suddenly becoming an administrative class. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's required for them to do that which will bring the funding to deliver the services. Then you have the operation of the electoral political system, where because the Democrats were in power and were quote-unquote ideologically favoring this particular approach, that, you know, Republicans saw this administrative class as being an arm of the Democratic Party, so they would go to defund it. In some cases, like Nixon's attempt to create a black bourgeoisie that ignored the one that existed, but rather, you know, would deliver funds directly to entrepreneurs, quote unquote, you know, looking to create either a competing group that was oriented towards the Republican Party or to disempower the one that was delivering, you know, voters to the Democratic Party. That struggle, of course, ignoring completely the needs of the people who are supposed to be serviced by this and creating an interest on behalf of the group on either side that was in opposition to their own constituency and leaving us with the condition that we face now.
Yeah, and now we see where that has turned. I mean, these...
And then,
these
I'm sorry, let me interrupt one more time. And finally, with the funding source being not the government and public funds, but now Wall Street. And so, you know, while the game goes on the ground, the puppeteers are no longer in Washington, but on Wall Street.
Exactly. And the nonprofit industrial complex has become exactly that. Before, when nonprofits were deployed by either party to siphon votes or to wield influence or to create, as you said, various class stratums that could ultimately empower their section of the ruling class. Now the ruling class, the capitalist class, holds complete ownership over the nonprofit industrial complex and how it wields this institutional weapon is very important, because ultimately for people of my generation, for people born, you know, after the war and poverty period, nonprofits have really become the sole venue from which one gets a job after college, but two, ultimately finds a place to channel their political energies into. And, you know, we can see this in the Trump era, where when a Democrat is in office, like Obama, a lot of these nonprofits operate much more in stealth, because of course there's barely any protests on the ground when Democrats are in office, among so-called progressives and leftists. And so these nonprofits are often operating in the background, the shadow. You call them shadow funds or shadow organizations like the Ford Foundation or, you know, the Google philanthropic arm, which gave money to Black Lives Matter affiliates. We know not many people knew that was happening. Not many people could see that was happening.
And you know what's cute? There's a website called GuideStar.org. It's GUIDESTAR.org. And you can search the names of a particular, you know, of different nonprofits. And among other things, you can see copies of their tax returns, where we have 1040s, they have 940s. And you can see major donors listed, the boards of directors, the officers of these nonprofit corporations. And you can see a lot of the things that you're discussing, you know, in black and white.
Exactly. And a lot of these organizations on their websites and how they advertise themselves aren't really very forthcoming about it, unless you do the research and look for those tax documents. And so, right now that a GOP presidential candidate has been elected in office, Donald Trump, especially given that Donald Trump possesses, you know, kind of a new set of contradictions that I don't think we've seen the Democratic Party affiliated nonprofits are in hyperdrive to use the money that the Democratic Party provides and Democratic Party capitalists, donors provide in order to re-energize the party for the coming electoral cycle. And, you know, I look at MoveOn.org because it is obviously the most present nonprofit in these protests against Donald Trump's policies. And, you know, just take a look. MoveOn.org is not very transparent, but if you look at their website and do some research, they do give their finances for 2015. And what you see is they're funded by one of the biggest Zionist organizations in the world, J Street, and a billionaire, Carrie Tuna, who gave tens of millions of dollars to the Hillary Clinton campaign. So just that alone shows that MoveOn.org has one mission and one mission only, and that is to, you know, retrieve the three branches of Washington and give them back to the Democratic Party.
Yep. And, you know, in the piece, you talk about some of the things that happened in the process of the deconstruction of the original CAP. The creation of successor programs, how this all related, for example, to the defunding of like HUD, that like 77% of its budget authority was stripped between 1978 to 1983 alone. Now, you're talking about the Reagan era, but actually we're talking about the Carter-Reagan era for that five-year period, evenly divided, actually more. I mean, Reagan took office January 20th, 1981. So, and that's just one of many. Accompanying that on the ground, homelessness, you know, evictions, stress on homeowners as well, low-income homeowners, those who are looking at federally insured and HUD insured and protected loans, all of that.
Exactly. And you can see the landscape now in most major cities in the United States where before a lot of federal funds were going to efforts to build public housing and to expand people's opportunities to have affordable housing. Now, most of the nonprofits work in the arena of homelessness and shelter and vouchers and things that provide that are, you know, ultimately bankrolled by either, you know, contracted out federal grants and state funds, more in the sense of, let's say, like a state block grant, like a lot of social services receive now from the federal government, or they operate completely on private funds. And so that's a big change. And a lot of times these nonprofits cannot even reach a small percentage of the people that really need the services, because ultimately the cuts to federal agencies and the cuts to social services are way too big for any, you know, one percenter, not, you know, philanthropist to make up. I mean, we're talking about the very cause of these problems. And so the same thing goes for social movements. When you have a social movement industry, and this goes both internationally too. I know Margaret Kimberly was on your show Thursday talking about Shamnesty International and Human Rights Watch. These, they provide the same sort of service to the ruling class on the international sphere, getting big money from the capitalist class in order to promote certain narratives and certain efforts that will ultimately promote regime change and destabilization abroad. So when you have a social movement industry doing this type of work, it really does influence the political landscape that people operate on. And we have to look at it, because if we do not, what we will end up with is insurgency that is led by the Democratic Party, like MoveOn.org, or insurgency that is led by you know, the war factions of the ruling class, like with Shamnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Talk about how we think about international affairs.
Yeah, you know, the article closes with, you know, the Democratic Party's, the party of Wall Street and war, that Obama's presidency helped clarify that for people that weren't getting it, although a lot of people still don't get it. But then Move On, funded by the same, you know, people that fund the Democratic Party, only without the restrictions that, you know, direct funding carries, that, you know, Obama's administration facilitated the largest transfer of wealth to the 1% in U.S. history. I mean, Glenn Ford has, you know, documented that very well, and had nothing to say about that, had nothing to say about Obama's unprecedented war on whistleblowers, and had nothing to say about single-payer health care while the discussion was going on that ultimately led to Obamacare. And that when the Democratic Party had majorities in Congress, they did not leverage at all to try to produce the kinds of things now that they claim to be raising against Trump.
Yeah, and just look at MoveOn.org, for example. When Obama was in office, they were quiet. And actually, if you look at their history, they talk about how proud they were to have formed out of the Clinton administration, where they did a huge political action campaign in order to save his administration from impeachment during the whole sex scandal.
The Clinton administration. Yeah, I mean, MoveOn, the name came from
the organization.
Yeah, I mean, right, exactly. You guys are trying to impeach Clinton. Move on. Get past this. That's where the name came from.
Yeah. Yeah. So their whole history is based on saving the Democratic Party from itself. And so whenever a Republican is in office, they claim, just like Democrats usually claim, to care about real, genuine problems of, you know, working class and oppressed people. But then when you look at their actions, you look at their narratives, and then you look at their funders, you see the reality of the situation, which is that this organization and that this nonprofit industrial complex, its sole purpose is to channels people's energy into legitimate forms of protest that can be used for the political interests of one of the two corporate parties, and in this case, it's the Democratic Party.
And more importantly, in favor of the very class that creates the contradictions that are being, you know, rebelled against or stood up against. So finally, let's look at what should people be doing to deal with it. I mean, the real problem is satisfying the needs that these organizations were set up supposedly to address as part of their mission statement and the magnet for whatever federal funds they do get. What can people be doing, or what should people be doing to try to actually deal with those needs? And by the way, to deal with these impediments to the realization of those needs or the satisfaction of those needs?
Right. It's a difficult question. You know, the revolution will not be funded by the 1%. It won't be funded by the ruling class. And so if nonprofits, their very structure and their very donor source is connected to the ruling class, then we have to start finding ways to organize on an independent basis that is not dependent on nonprofit funds and structures. I think Bruce Dixon talked a lot about this in the practical sense, where whatever political organizations that do arise in this period to attempt to harness the working class resentment that this entire election cycle has produced and has sort of laid bare for a lot of people to see, I think we need to start thinking about, well, how do we fund those organizations on an independent basis? How do we go back and look at due structures and various ways to appeal to the community so we can start getting people together and producing sustainable organizations that produce sustainable political action and political education? Because that's one of the biggest struggles that we have right now because of the nonprofit industrial complex, because the nonprofit industrial complex is so tied to the ruling class that the ruling class is creating the rules and ultimately creating the terms with which we can operate under. And we see the result of it. We see that a lot of genuine activists become subsumed and sucked into this behemoth. We have to find a way to challenge it. And the first thing we have to do is expose a nonprofit industrial complex for what it really is in order to show people what an independent alternative looks like.
Danny Haifong has a weekly column at blackagendareport.com. This week's column, Why It's Time to Move On, from MoveOn.org and the Nonprofit Industrial Complex. Thank you very much, Dan. A pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don. Pleasure too.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.